session number 17896, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Major General Corran Purdon, recorded by Rodney Giesler in Devizes on the 13th of February 1998 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Can you tell me, first of all, General Purdon, when were you born?
4th of May 1921.
And you come from a military family, I believe.
Well, my father was a Major General, Royal Army Medical Corps, and we have a lot of military antecedents. My family are all either soldiers or doctors. In fact, I'll show you 12 sets of family medals in the dining room when we have lunch.
Fantastic. Where were you born?
I was born in Cork, mm-hmm. Rushbrook, County Cork, when my father was serving during the Troubles, the Sinn Féin Troubles of 1921.
And I believe you went to India as a child.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I can't honestly remember which year we went there, but I was there until I was five. And then my father's time out there at that time finished, and he came home and brought my mother, my sister, myself back, and we went and lived in Belfast with my mother's father. My father went back to India for another few years.
Do you remember anything about India?
Oh, yes, I do. I loved India. I do, very vividly do I remember India.
What are some of the memories? What can you remember from your childhood?
Well, I remember glaring white sunlight on the walls of my parents' bungalow. I remember they had three earthen tennis courts. I remember the blaze of flowers that we had there, the different colours. I remember how awfully nice the Indian servants were. I remember really the smell of the place. I had a pony out there. I used to go and ride every morning before breakfast with my father round the Maidan at the Gymkhana Club. And I remember very vividly the notes of the silver bugles of the then Royal Irish Rifles, which my father had been MO to in Burma in 1910 at Mae Mew, and was the regiment that I joined when they became Royal Ulster Rifles, and with which I, and incidentally in which I'd had other relations serving as well. So those really are my memories. And my wife...
What part of India was this?
Wellington, which is where their staff college is now. Bangalore.
In the south, in other
words. In the south, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And can you remember the moment when you yourself decided to be a soldier? Or did it gradually impinge itself on you?
I honestly think I always wanted to be one. I mean, I can never remember not wanting to be a soldier. So probably the moment I could think properly. I mean, I used to dress up as a soldier when I was a tiny boy, and I had an awful lot of lead soldiers. And I always wanted to be a soldier.
What was it? Was it the sort of the sense of adventure pertaining to it, or the glamour of the uniform? The disciplined life?
I don't think I ever really thought as deeply about that. It just seemed to me quite natural that I would be a soldier, and that when I retired, I would live in the south of Ireland, which is what I had planned to do. I never had any particular regiment that I wanted to join until just before I went to Sandhurst. My father wanted me to be a sapper because he said sappers always got on best in the army. Well, you know that when you're 17 or 18, you're not thinking of getting on in the army, you're thinking of joining a regiment and being a platoon commander. My thoughts never went further than that. And it was quite apparent to my father, as it had been to me for a long time, that my mathematics were not my strongest point. And so he reluctantly agreed I wouldn't try and be a sapper and that I'd go in the infantry. And then he said, well, there's only one regiment for you, which is the Royal Ulster Rifles, because we come from the... Although we came originally from the south of Ireland, my great-something grandfather moved up north after Waterloo and set up as a doctor in Belfast. And really, the Ulster Rifles are Belfast's regiment, although they were two battalions, and one was the Royal County Down, and the other was the 83rd County of Dublin Regiment. But we've always looked upon ourselves as, by the very title of Ulster Rifles. So that's why I joined them, and my father's connections from having been medical officer.
Now, you, in your teens, when you were, before you went to Sandhurst,
yes.
These were the sort of worrying 30s, and Hitler was coming to power.
Yes.
War was always obviously gathering.
I yes.
Mean, did you and your father talk about the coming of war? And
no.
Nothing at all?
No. I don't ever remember talking to anyone about it until I went to Sandhurst. No.
I mean,
we knew it was going to... No, that's not true. One knew war was coming, obviously. I mean, from the way Hitler was, and they always hoped it wasn't going to come. It sounded so dreadful. But my father and I never discussed it, and I could never get my father, incidentally, to talk about the First World War.
I was going to ask you that. Mm.
Yes. Where he'd been very much a decorated officer and so on, but I could never get him to talk about it. He might tell me something like, oh, I had in my field ambulance a wonderful chap who threw the cricket ball for South Africa, and we used to send him up to throw hand grenades, for the forward troops when he wasn't operating. Or that they'd been up for I don't know how many hours without any sleep. But I could never get him to talk about it, no.
Because you write in your book that, unlike a lot of medical officers, he spent a lot of time with the troops on the front.
He did, actually, yes.
Even going into no man's land.
He used to go over the top with the leading infantry. I don't know whether he always did it, but I know that I was told that by someone who'd served in the York and Lancaster Regiment. He was the 2nd Battalion Regimental Medical Officer, and that's where he got his MC. And he said he went over the top with them so he could deal with the wounded when they fell, which I thought was a pretty good effort.
Yes. And when you think of the sort of the odds on,
I know, being not, I know.
Any attack.
And he only got wounded once, and that was by a shell splinter in his thumb. That was all. Never wounded.
Yes.
Apart from that.
Now, you went to Sandhurst, what, in the autumn of 39?
In the summer of 39, and I was the very last batch of what were then called gentlemen cadets. And Field Marshal Raleigh Gibbs and I were contemporaries. We went there together.
And, of course, war was a definite fact
yes.
by that time.
Yes, yeah.
Was the course at Sandhurst truncated in the sense that they wanted to get you through as quickly as possible?
Yes, yes. We started off, you see, with the... war wasn't declared until the 3rd of September. I think I went there at the end of July. And so we started off doing all the normal Sandhurst curriculum, administration and morale, field sketching, things like that. And then the war broke out. GHQ, British Expeditionary Force, formed at the Staff College, and I also saw them in the buildings at Sandhurst as well. And then they went off over to France. And we then really did what I suppose would be called an OCTU course after that. I mean, you learned to be a platoon commander.
And that's, you graduated from Sandhurst the following spring, did you?
No, I'd graduated on the 31st of December, 1939. I only did 6 months there. And I then went straight over to the depot of the Royal Ulster Rifles, which was then at Armagh. And I stayed there only until January, and we had formed what was called the Royal Ulster Rifles Infantry Training Centre at Ballymena, in the grounds of Ballymena Castle, and a tremendous amount of building was going on, and I went up with the advance party, and we lived in what was being built for our post-war depot, or not post-war, pre-war depot, sorry. And then gradually everyone moved up. We gave up Armagh, and I think the Irish Fusiliers moved in there. They've been there ever since. I stayed at Ballymena until, I think, about April or May 1940. And I had hoped that I was going to get out to our 2nd Battalion in France. And A, I looked very young, and B, I was young, and I was underage to go to France. And that was bloody awful, because a chap who had been at Sandhurst with me, called Teddy Darcy, he managed to get out there. And I felt absolutely frightful that I hadn't been with the 2nd Battalion. So when they started calling for volunteers for the commandos, I think this was about June, I volunteered. And my colonel, who was an old friend of my father's, turned down my application. I didn't know. I didn't hear anything. And I went along to the orderly room, and I was a bit of a friend of the orderly room quartermaster sergeant. And I said to him, what happened to my application? He said, Colonel Carley tore it up. So I applied again, and the same thing happened. So I heard that Colonel Peachy Harrison, who was raising number 12 commando, actually in Londonderry, was over. And so I went along to another friend of mine who was the MT sergeant. And I got one of these utility vans. And he and I went off to Derry, and I saw Colonel Harrison. I said, look, I'd love to volunteer. And my colonel's turned me down twice. He said, oh, the ACI said that all volunteers, no one could be stopped volunteering. And I said, will you take me, sir? And he said, of course I will. Yeah, I'd love to. So I then went back, and I was then called for number 12 commando. And my colonel was very angry with me, called me and gave me a terrific rocket. Said he was going to stop me going. And I said, well, sir, I don't think you can. anyway, I went. And he forgave me later on.
Can I just go back?
Yes, of course. Sorry, I'm rambling on.
No, this is all interesting stuff. But before I forget the question, when you were doing your opto training at Sandhurst,
yes.
You know, learning to be an infantryman,
yes.
Learning how to fight in different geographical situations, if you like, you know, wooded, open country or whatever.
Yes.
Presumably you were also taught the lessons learned in the First War about static fighting and the sterility of trench warfare and how to get
no.
or anything like that. There's no sort of historical reference.
No. I dare say there would have been had the war not started, we might have. But no, you were just taught to be a platoon commander, platoon attack, platoon and defence, withdrawal, you know, advance to contact, patrolling, field signals, that sort of thing. It was very basic. The idea was that when they churned you out and you went to a platoon, you wouldn't be lost.
And what weapons were you trained with then?
Well, we had the old SMLE, you know, the old 303 rifle. We had the Bren light machine gun. We had the 2-inch mortar. What else? We had the boys' anti-tank rifle. Actually, at Sandhurst, when we were doing exercises, there were so few of the mortars and the anti-tank rifles. They had dummies, and you'd carry a wooden 2-inch mortar around with you, and you'd carry a sort of wooden boys' anti-tank rifle. But they did have them, and you were properly trained on them.
So you could strip, you were taught to strip a brain.
Oh, God, yes. There's no question about that. I mean, and you knew jolly well that you were going to do that in front of your soldiers, and you must be able to do it probably better than them, if possible, you know. No, we had the most superb instructors at Sandhurst. I mean, they were the cream of the British Army, the NCOs who instructed us. I mean, the guards took us for drill, and then we had various line regiments who taught us weapon training. And it was very thorough indeed. I was very confident in my ability, you know, on weapons.
Now, when you went on to train as a commando, the commando name actually came from the Boer War.
That's right. The Dennis Reitz's book. Yes.
Now, was there a sort of syllabus set up for that, or did you learn as you went along?
If there was a syllabus, I don't know of it. We knew that our job was raiding across the Channel at that stage, and that some of us would probably go to the Middle East and carry out raids there should we be wanted. But at the moment, we were only thinking of raiding across the Channel. And therefore, our training, you see, a commando had six troops in it. at least mine did, and each troop was commanded by a captain, and there were two sections. A troop was 65, and you had the headquarters, which was 5, two sections of 30, and they were organized in two subsections. So you didn't do platoon tactics exactly, but then we trained in everything, in the assault, in defense, particularly in patrolling at night. We did a hell of a lot of that. Cross-country movement, and the harder the country, the more likely we were going to have to do it. And they really, they went for superb physical fitness, perfection if possible, in all weapons, and that included hand grenades and the funny old bombs they used to have then, sticky tank bombs, and then we had to fire this extraordinary boy's anti-tank rifle, and we all fired the 2-inch mortar.
The training was a lot more strenuous.
Very strenuous. Terrible.
The word didn't exist, but there was a lot of yomping in those days.
Yes, absolutely right, yeah. Mm.
And were you taught to live off the land as well?
Yes. Mm. I went up, and a number of our officers went up to Loch Eilert, to the commando training centre there, which was before Achnacarry, and Colonel Hugh Stockwell, later General Sir Hugh Stockwell, was our commanding officer, a wonderful man who'd commanded an independent company in the Norwegian campaign, and we all thought the world of him. And we did very tough training up there, including, you know, shooting weapons and all that. Of course, with those mountains there, we were superbly fit. They absolutely bent us. But we also did a lot of demolition training up there as well.
And I suppose you had to use the knife, or we trained to use
Well, I've never used mine. I don't know how many did.
The
other ranks always say they've used them. I mean, I heard the other day, a chap came to visit me here, and he said, oh, well, he was told that that you weren't allowed to put your fighting knife away unless it had been dipped in an enemy's blood, which, to my point of view, was utter balls, but you wore it strapped to your ankle normally, or to your thigh. Mm. And it was a very lethal thing, for, which, as you probably know, was the creation of two wonderful old chaps, Fairbairn and Sykes, who'd been chief inspectors, I think, in the Royal Hong Kong Police Force. And that's why it's called the FS knife. It's Fairbairn and Sykes. It was a beautiful knife. I mean, a lovely thing, and a little sheath. We did actually, come to think of it, I had to kill a sheep with mine when we were up at Loch Eilert. We had to kill sheep and then skin them and then cook them. And, of course, they were as tough as hell, poor little things.
Now, the first operation you went off in the commandos was in Norway, wasn't it?
Yes, but in fact, my boat, we never landed.
Uh-huh.
We broke down and we were in the Shetland Islands getting repaired. Then we steamed off into Norwegian waters and we met our force coming back because they'd gone there, they'd landed, they had overcome the German garrison who were sleeping off there.
Was that the Vauxhall Raid?
No, this was Lofoten, second Lofoten Islands.
Yeah.
There was so much bombing that the Naval Task Force commander apparently decided that they couldn't stay there. We were going to actually stay there for months. We'd all been fitted out with white sort of canvas, or whatever they were, uniforms, you know, to wear over our battle dress and so on. No, we're terribly disappointed. At the same time, the Vauxhall Raid took place, which was a terrific success, of course.
What would have been your job if you'd stayed there for a month?
We were never told. I mean, all I knew was that I'd do what my troop commander told me to do. I think they thought we would go in country, and if there were any German garrisons, we hopefully would take them out. So that was very disappointing, and that's why I think my colonel knew I was so disappointed. I got on very well with him. And that's why I was selected, among other people, for the San Nazaire raid, which followed so shortly afterwards.
The San Nazaire raid was what, in March?
28th of March, 1942.
42?
Yes.
Now, this is a well-documented operation and so on.
Yes, there's a new book coming out on it next month called Storming San Nazaire by a chap called Jim Dorion, a young Canadian.
Can you tell me a bit about how you prepared for that raid?
Yes. First of all, if I could say that I was demolition troops, so we had to be trained really for dock demolitions. So having been called from my commando with two other officers, Gerard Brett and Paul Bassett Wilson, and 13 of my men, we went down to Southampton, where we were trained on the King George V dock in destroying the big Cassoon gates at either end of the dry dock, the winding house machinery that operated the Cassoon gates that moved them in and out, the pump house that actually pumped the water in and out of the dry dock, and the impeller pumps, which were way down, sort of in a basement part, cranes, trains, really anything that you would expect to find, little bridges that opened and shut, you know. We were taught where to put our charges, we were taught how to make charges up, we were taught how to link them up in a circuit so that they would go off, that we were taught the different ways of ignition. You know, the different, you have a pull switch, a press switch, you had your fusee match and so on. And then we went to Cardiff docks, and there were a number of our people who were training at Cardiff docks, and they swapped over to Southampton docks to give us the maximum experience on large docks we could get. We were given an awful lot of lectures on it by a chap called Bill Pritchard, whose father was the superintendent of the Cardiff docks. And Bill was a sapper who got an MC in Dunkirk. I think he blew up a bridge or something there under fire. And we were trained by him and a fellow called Bob Montgomery, another sapper captain. Really, until we could lay our charges in the dark as well as in daylight on anything. And with our teams, a team was an officer and four, that you all had to be able to do each other's job. So if and when people were killed, you could still do it, and therefore the demolition would take place unless you were all wiped out.
So the question arises, that why couldn't that huge grading dock in San Jose have been destroyed from the air?
Well, in fact, Bill Pritchard, who was a dock demolition expert, said that all you would do would make craters in the docks around it, and you'd be very, very lucky if you did, in fact, hit it. And the only way really to do it was to put men in, actually on the ground, and physically make sure that it was blown up. And it was the Navy actually going on who decided on the idea of going in and a destroyer with 4 or 5 tons of high explosive packed in the bows and blow it up. But in fact, originally, before that concept, we were going to go in and blow it up the same way we blew up the far end of the dry dock, the Cassoon gate there, which of course couldn't be rammed by a destroyer. That was destroyed by chaps and my commando. And we reckon we could have blown up the dock without the ship going into it, had we been able to get
now,
there.
Now that's interesting, because the bits and pieces of the dock you just described are enormous, great lumps of metal.
Yes.
Now, presumably it was the precision with which explosives were placed.
That's it.
Which enabled you to use comparatively small amounts of explosives.
That's right, yes. We carried about anything from 60 to 90 pounds of explosive and aids to the explosive in our backs.
That's a lot of weight.
In our packs, it is a lot of weight.
Plus your weapons.
Yeah, well, all we had, in fact, the demolition troops were the only ones who carried these bloody great Bergens on our backs, and we had to have just an automatic pistol, a Colt, because you simply couldn't really, you needed your hands free anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the raid itself, that was quite a cheeky operation, really, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
I mean, you went in flying German naval ensigns and things.
Until fire was opened on us.
Yes.
And then the white ensign was broken at the mast.
And you left Falmouth in daylight.
Yes.
So you could have
on the 26th. Yes, we could have. But we were rather lucky. We had an overcast on the 27th. And we were spotted by a German U-boat. And in fact, I've met the U-boat commander because he survived the war. But the formation we were in was such, it was an anti-submarine sweep formation. And we hoped that anyone who did see us would think we're just a normal British naval force on an anti-submarine sweep.
But they weren't towing motor launches, weren't they?
No, not towing them. They were all... The only thing that was towed was the MTB. Everything else went under its own steam. There were 16 MLs. The force was led by the motor gunboat, which was Commander Bob Ryder, and my two commando, Colonel Charles Newman, on board the MGB. And then Campbelltown behind. And Campbelltown towed the MTB with Mickey Wynne, who was the skipper, now Lord Newborough. And then on either side, we'd 8 MLs. And they all went across Fairmile motor launches. They went across under their own steam, carrying a huge container of high-octane petrol to get them back again. And of course, you can imagine what happened when we were open fire on. Even though the idea was that they used the high-octane fuel in the containers on the way over, and the idea was you then had your normal petrol tanks to take you back, should you get back.
I know you were young and actively minded, in the sense that you were in perhaps the most active kind of fighting force there was.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel before the raid? Were you nervous? Did you... I mean, they say that imagination makes a bad soldier.
Yes.
Were you lacking imagination?
I tell you what, I was frightened that I would show fear in front of my men if I was frightened. I didn't know whether I was going to be or not, but what I wanted to do was for them not to know if I was. But in point of fact, I discovered that as soon as anything happened when we were going up the river and we were fired on, you had no time to feel frightened. You knew you'd got a task to do when you got ashore. You knew you'd four men for whom you were responsible and who were your team. And quite honestly, I hadn't time to feel frightened. I was terrified I was going to feel frightened, but I didn't.
And when, you know, fire started...
Yeah.
Coming across you in all
yeah,
directions.
Yeah.
I mean, one's instinctive feeling is to cower under cover and keep out of the way.
Well, we were under cover, luckily.
I know. when you were on Campbelltown.
Yes, I was. Yes.
And you leapt off it.
Yes.
With your huge pack.
Yes.
And there was stuff coming at you in all directions.
Yes.
But presumably, you pushed it out of your mind. Or
yes.
What?
Yeah. Well, everyone did.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to. If you stood and thought about it, you'd know the thing was to get on. And that was the advantage of being an officer, because you were in charge and you had these four men. I mean, no way could you let them down, you know. I mean, you had to. They were looking to you, and if you looked in the least bit hesitant, you were a bloody useless leader.
Yeah.
So one had to give the impression... of being thoroughly on the ball and unconcerned.
Presumably you had supporting troops anyway that would look out for where the fire was coming from and took it out.
Well, the immediate weapons on either side of the dock were taken out by two assault parties, and they were taken out brilliantly by them. But of course there were people firing from all over the place at the Campbelltown. Once we started running up the side of the dry dock, which is about 400-yard run, we were really in the shadows, and it was only if a searchlight got you that you were going to be seen. So there was a hell of a lot of fire coming, but I don't reckon it was particularly aimed as far as we were concerned.